Well, good evening. Sorry to have to tell you that the guy he was describing couldn't come, so you have to settle for me instead. I don't know who that guy is. Doug asked me, I'm really glad to be here. This is really great. North Dakota is my 50th state. So yesterday, I actually got to visit North Dakota twice. And so this is my second time in North Dakota. After he picked me up at the airport, we went across into Minnesota. So that makes this my second time in North Dakota. But it's really nice to be here with you. I know that you're thinking, someone out there is thinking, you saved the best for last. And I won't dispute that with you. But really, really appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today and to talk about these things. We have really an impossible task in the time that's given to us, but I hope it will be edifying. And where is the clock? You said that there was a clock somewhere. Man, I cannot see it. It must be my glasses. So I'll have to use my wristwatch. Oh, good, it's only 3 o'clock. I hope that it'll be okay if I ask you a couple of questions along the way, and if I stop, what time is supper? That's very helpful. 6? Okay, so if we stop and give the opportunity for some questions, will that be okay? All right, good. We really have an impossible task. What I want to do in the next 45 minutes is cover about 100 years worth of English history, and I don't know how I will do that. I have become more and more convinced that if we are properly to understand who we are as Baptists, that we must understand the English Reformation. There's just no way around it. Our history and our identity is tied up with the things that happened in the 16th century in England. And so what I want to do in this hour is to talk about the 16th century in England, try to describe to you something of the nature of that Reformation. And that will prepare us for our second hour tonight, where we can tell the story of how the English Baptists came into existence in the 17th century. Now, here's where I want to begin. I want to ask a question, and I see that there are some young people in our midst, so maybe they can help me and try to answer this question. But here's the first one. Who is the most famous king in English history? And I'm willing to entertain a couple of different possibilities. I have at least 3 in my mind that are likely to come up. But let's see what kind of answers we get. What do you think? Who's the most famous king in English history? Oh, Henry VIII. Very good, Linda. You hit the nail on the head. Sometimes I expect someone will say King Arthur, and, we don't even know if there really was a King Arthur, but you expect that. Or one of the kids last week, I was talking about these things in Texas, and one of the kids suggested Richard the Lionhearted, and I thought, well, that would be a good answer as well. But Henry VIII is the guy that we want to especially think about today. Now, who was his son who followed him to the throne? Does anybody know that, the answer to that question? Yes? Edward, very good. Do you know what number Edward was? Oh, he wasn't 3. You did really well to get Edward. I think that's fantastic. But he was Edward VI, so there were 5 Edwards before him. All right, now, next question. Who were the 2 daughters of Henry VIII who followed Edward to the throne of England? See if you can name them for me. You're doing really well. I'm very impressed. Go ahead. One is Elizabeth. She was the 2nd one. That's right. And she reigned for almost 50 years. Who was the other one? Mary. I hear Mary over here. That's right. Mary was the other one. So for about 100 years, from 1509 to 1603, you have Henry VIII and 3 of his children who are on the throne of the Kingdom of England. And it's their story that I want to try to tell to you right now. Now, so this is called How the Reformation Came to England, and it's a very strange story, and it actually reminds me of Habakkuk 1:5. In our church back in Escondido, I'm teaching a Sunday school class on the book of Habakkuk. And so it's been in my mind a lot lately. Habakkuk 1:5 says this, "Look among the nations and watch, be utterly astounded, for I will work a work in your days which you would not believe, though it were told you." And in some ways, that's how I think of the Reformation in England. It seems to me like a very strange story, how God did something very unexpected and very unusual with some very strange characters, and yet the end result of that Reformation is really who we are and what we're all about. Now, just to give you a demonstration of this, I want to read to you a description that was written by a man in about the year 1685. His name was Edward Terrell, and he was an elder in a church in the western England city of Bristol. Bristol was probably the second largest or second most important city in England after London. And Terrell was the elder in a Baptist church. It's called the Broadmead Church. It still exists, Broadmead Baptist Church. And he kept the records for his church, and they've been reprinted for us. You can actually buy the book, and you can read this firsthand account of the life of his church. It's fascinating stuff. Near the beginning, he spends, 30 or 40 pages telling the story of how his church came into existence. And at one point, he takes 12 steps, and through those 12 steps, describes the process in a brief way of how his church came into existence. Now, it's really interesting to read all 12 steps, and I have them here with me, but I won't take the time to do that. I just want to read the first two steps. And you need to listen closely to what he says, and remember that this guy was an elder in a Baptist church in England. In fact, it's one of the churches that first adopted our confession of faith. And notice how his identity and his description of his Baptist church directly relates to the story I'm about to tell you. So listen to this. This is his first and his second points out of the 12 in his history of his own church. Ready? Here we go. "First of all, the Lord alone, by his Spirit, not by might nor by power, opened their eyes and made them cast off the body of false doctrines of the Church of Rome that had so long deceived the nations and made them drunk with the wine of her fornication, worshipping under pretense the true God in a false manner, wresting the Holy Scriptures to their own damnation, saying the real presence of Christ was in the sacrament that signified his body by a transubstantiation, and teaching that man's works merit salvation and works of supererogation." Now, that's a big theological word. It just means works that go beyond what God expects from us. Now, what's he describing here? He's describing the Reformation under Luther that took place across the English Channel on the European continent. That's what he's describing in his first point. Rome had been in the ascendancy. People looked to Rome. They had depended on Rome. Rome had lost the gospel, but God raised up men who recovered the gospel, and Rome was put down by that action. Now, listen to his second point. He crosses the channel now. "Secondly, the Lord put it into the hearts of some in authority in this nation to cast off the body of the worship of Rome, as well as their doctrine, namely the nest of idolaters, even to cast out the monks, friars, abbots, priests, masses, advocation of saints with praying for the deceased, etc. These things were done long before." Now, there's two things that I've read so far in this paragraph that tells you he's moving across the channel from Germany to England, and that he's describing something that happened long before. Okay? He says those things to us. Now, his next couple of phrases are really interesting, and he uses some language that's not familiar to us. He uses first a word spelled R-U-F-F, rough. Now, you can get a sense of what the word rough means by thinking of the English word ruffle. What is a ruffle on your clothing? It's usually something that's put on to add some interest to your clothing, isn't it? And there used to be a style in the 16th century in England and in the Netherlands especially of something that was called a ruff that was worn around the neck. You've seen pictures of this. It's a very flamboyant type of dress that would be put around the neck to go between your clothing and your head. And it would, many times it would come out way out like this, and it would be sort of vain looking. Well, when he uses the word rough, he means vainglorious. That's exactly what he means, okay? He follows it almost immediately with the word rough, R-O-U-G-F. And when he uses that word, he means arrogant. In the 17th century, someone who was rough would be an arrogant person. So when you hear me read the words rough and rough, think vainglorious and arrogant, okay? Listen to what he says. These things were done long before, for which rough, vainglorious, and rough, arrogant work, God chose and fitted rough spirits to do it. And that time it's R-O-U-G-H, arrogant. More for their own interest and concern than aiming at God's glory, so through man's own private ends, the wise Lord managed his own good pleasure. And the next four words are really interesting. Now, do you hear what he said? He says that God used these events for his own purpose, even though the men who acted these works did not intend them for God's glory. The Reformation came to England this way. What are the next four words? Witness King Henry VIII. Those are his final four words. Here, Edward Terrell recognizes that the Reformation came to England as a result of the strange actions of King Henry VIII, and then they develop for approximately the next 100 years. Now, why is it important for us to understand these things? Let me suggest a couple of reasons for you. First off, and I've already hinted at this, it helps us to understand our own roots. Our confession of faith and our Puritan-era Baptist fathers were all shaped by the 150 or so years that preceded them. Our confession of faith comes to us in a context, and we need to understand that context because it influences our own interpretation of that confession. It is what it is as a result of the events that came before. Secondly, it's important for us to understand these things because it helps us to understand the nature of English Puritanism. Even much of American history has been molded by English Puritanism. Listen to John Owen, that great Puritan, as he writes. He says, "And as for those of latter days, though the names of the principal and most eminent of them, as Bucer, Calvin, Martyr, Beza, are now condemned and despised by many, mostly by those who never once seriously attempted the exposition of any one chapter in the whole of Scripture, yet those who firmly design to grow in the knowledge of God and our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ both do and always will bless God for the assistance he gave them in their great and holy works and in the benefit which they receive by their labors." Owen here is pointing to four men who are fundamentally important for the English Reformation. Now, you know the name of Calvin. You may know the name of his successor, Theodore Beza. We'll hardly say anything about each of them today, but you might not have known the other two names, Martin Bucer and Peter Martyr Vermeely. Now, you might not have heard those names, but they are incredibly important for the English Reformation. Bucer was in Strasbourg. When Calvin had to flee from Geneva, he went and lived in the city there with Bucer and ministered alongside of him. And when Edward came to the throne, King Edward VI, his ministers invited Bucer to come, and Bucer became the leading theological professor at the University of Cambridge. Likewise, Peter Martyr Vermeely, he was a Roman Catholic who came to understand the gospel, came to Strasbourg, worked alongside of Bucer, and when King Edward came to the throne, they invited Bucer to come, and he became Regius Professor of Divinity at Oxford, the highest position of theological instruction at the University of Oxford. The two leading theologians of the English Reformation were Bucer and Peter Martyr Vermeely, who were themselves recognized as great leaders, and here Owen points them out. See, Owen wants us to give thanks to God for the work that was done in the 16th century by these men. Remember, our confession of faith is a Puritan document. It is the heir of this theological tradition. And it is right for us to say that our roots are in English Puritanism, and the roots of English Puritanism are the roots of the English Reformation. Now, I have to skip over a lot of this material just for the sake of time. Let me rush on and get to King Henry VIII. Now, Henry VIII, as we've already said, is one of the most famous and important kings in English history. And he captures the popular imagination. Last year, 2009, was the 500th anniversary of his accession to the throne of England. And we, my wife and I and some friends, were in England last year, and we visited Hampton Court Palace, which was one of his palaces. And we learned that Henry VIII still makes a lot of money for any property in England that can in any way tie itself to Henry VIII. And last year, being the 500th anniversary, they made money hand over fist because they found ways to connect what they were doing to Henry VIII. The day that we were at Hampton Court Palace, they had a guy, an actor, dressed up as Henry VIII, greeting all of us. They also had one of his wives and some of his henchmen who were dressed up and playing in character and taking us on tour and telling us about their story as we walked through the palace. He's a fascinating character and still captures the imagination of many today. Here's some facts about him, simple facts. He was born June 28, 1491. Now, the easiest way to remember that is to remember that in 1492, you know the rest of the rhyme, right? Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Well, the year before Columbus is the year that Henry VIII was born. He died in 1547 when he was 55 years old. So that was a fairly common lifespan for his day. What we know about the lifespan in the 16th century was that the most dangerous time was up until late teenage years. Much of the population died off by the time they got to 20. But if you lived to 20, you could probably expect to live to about 50 or 60 years old. And some lived up into their 90s. So Henry lived probably an average life. Now, it has been suggested that when he died, he may have weighed as much as 450 pounds. Imagine that. If you ever get a chance to see the various portraits of Henry, you see how when he was a young man, he was known for his fitness because he loved sports. In fact, one of the complaints that was made about him when he was 18 years old and came to the throne is that he was unconcerned with the governance of the realm and was more concerned with going out hunting or jousting or doing anything that had to do with the popular sports of the day, and just left it to his ministers, the men in charge who were under him, to take care of the everyday ruling of government, and that caused some difficulty. His father was a man who was a very hands-on king. Henry VIII was a man who was a very hands-off king because he wanted to indulge himself. And the idea is that he spent all of his father's money and he lived a life of luxury and indulgence. And that accounts for the fact that he went from a 32-inch waist to a 52-inch waist when he died. In January of 1536, when he was about 45 years old, he was very seriously injured in a jousting accident. A tournament was set up, and he went and he participated in the tournament. Now, you know what jousting is. You've seen it in movies. Two guys line up across from each other on horses, and they get up. They're carrying lances. They get up to full speed, and they try to knock the other off the horse. Henry was involved in that. This is the King of England. He loved it. He's knocked off the horse, and for 2 hours, he was unconscious. Now, there are all kinds of theories about what happened to him. One of them, which seems reasonable, is that perhaps he incurred a brain injury. But his demeanor for about the last 10 years of his life does take a change. And he becomes more aggressive and more tyrannical. And more people lose their heads as a result of the change that seems to come to Henry VIII's personality. Likewise, he obtained in this fall a very serious wound to his leg. And he never recovered from it. For the last 11 years of his life, he was in pain. In fact, one description of the wound, it was an open sore of some kind. They say that it was so bad that you couldn't approach within about 30 feet of the king without being overcome by the odor from this wound. And he lived with this for 11 years. They had to cut his armor in a certain way because he couldn't wear armor that would cover the wound in his leg. It must have been a horrible thing. So you have this immense man who becomes a tyrant and who carries around in his leg a wound. It was a bad situation. He was crowned as king in 1509, 4 days before his 18th birthday. His father had died. He reigned for just less than 38 years. Now, for the first two decades of his reign, the first 20 years, he was a faithful Roman Catholic. In fact, he earned the title Defender of the Faith from Pope Leo X. And the reason that the Pope gave him this title is that he wrote a treatise against Martin Luther. It's entitled a Disputation on the Seven Sacraments. The Pope was so pleased with it that he granted to Henry the title Defender of the Faith. Even today, the English monarch carries that title. You may have heard that Charles, Prince Charles, wants to change it slightly. And if he ever becomes king, he wants to be known not as Defender of the Faith, but as Defender of Faith. Now, there's a difference between those two, if you think about what that difference is. Henry is perhaps most famous for the fact that he had how many wives? Do you remember how many wives Henry had? You all know that he had a lot of wives, right? And for those of you from my generation, you remember Herman's Hermits and their song about the wives of Henry VIII. Well, it wasn't really about him. The singer said, "I'm Henry VIII, I am, I am." Remember that song? How many wives did Henry have? Do you remember? Yes, sir? Six wives! Very good. Very good. Henry had six wives. You know, there's a rhyme that has been used to help us remember the fate of his six wives. And it goes like this. Divorced, beheaded, died. Divorced, beheaded, survived. That's what happened to his six wives. Now, it's technically not accurate, because the first wife was not divorced, the marriage was annulled, and we'll talk about that in a little while. Nevertheless, it's helpful. Divorced, beheaded, died. Divorced, beheaded, survived. Catherine of Aragon, the marriage is annulled. Anne Boleyn is executed. Jane Seymour gives birth to Edward VI and dies as a result of childbirth. Anne of Cleves, the fourth wife, that marriage is divorced. The fifth wife was, I have it in my notes here in front of me, Catherine Howard. She committed adultery. She was beheaded. The sixth wife outlived Henry, so she survived. Divorced, beheaded, died. Divorced, beheaded, survived. Now, these simple facts mask the complexities that are associated with Henry and the Reformation. A couple of other things that we need to remember. Martin Luther was born in 1483. Which made him 8 years older than Henry. And we should say that there was a mutual loathing society between Henry VIII and Martin Luther. It's one of the oddities of the Reformation. They couldn't stand each other. They never met. But Luther was offended at the fact that Henry wrote a tract against him and received the title from the Pope, and Henry didn't like anything about Martin Luther. So they loathed each other. But Luther was about 8 years older than Henry. Second thing we need to remember is that Luther was publishing and advocating Reformation from around 1517. Henry doesn't begin the process really of Reformation for at least another 10 years. So our discussions about the Reformation in England come as a result of the last half of Henry's reign as king. Now, there are some complex issues or complexities that we need to recognize about Henry. The first of them has to do with the legitimacy of the Tudor family rule and succession. You know that kings take names to their families. The current Queen of England is from the House of Windsor. Henry was from the House of Tudor. And his father, who was also named Henry, Henry VII, was the founder of the Tudor family. You maybe know of the name Tudor from architecture. I like Tudor houses. I just think they look quaint with the wood and the white and all the rest. That comes from the Tudor family and the reign of the Tudors. Now, we usually think of the legitimacy of the Tudor family after Henry, but we need to think about it before as well, because that has everything to do with what happened. The claim to the throne that was made by Henry VIII's father, and his name was Henry VII, was tenuous. Because he had seized power on the battlefield in 1485, and over the course of the next 15 years or so, he eliminated potential rivals to the throne by execution. Now what that meant is that Henry's father came to a throne that was bathed in blood. And Henry was well aware of the fact that there were those who claimed that the Tudor dynasty was illegitimate, that is, they did not belong to the rightful line of succession over the kingship of England. He was only the second monarch of the House of Tudor. And he was well aware of the potential dispute that was to be made against his family. And so one of his great concerns in moving forward was to cement his position and that of his families for the future. He wanted to ensure that the Tudor dynasty could go on. That was a great concern that he had. Now, there's more that's involved in this. Think about Henry's place on the throne. You know, Henry was actually the second son of King Henry VII. That means that he was not the first and natural heir to the throne. Henry actually had an older brother whose name was Arthur. Yes, England might have had a King Arthur. Arthur had been prepared for the throne from his childhood because he was the first child, the first son. The oldest son was always the heir apparent. Henry, by his father, had been intended for the church, and it's thought that Henry VII, the father, had in mind to put Arthur on the throne and Henry in charge of the Church of England. Thus, the Tudor family would have control of the two great entities of the day, state through the kingdom and church as Archbishop of Canterbury. And so Henry spent some of his young life preparing for a religious vocation while Arthur was prepared for the kingship. Arthur, when he was 2 years old, was engaged to marry Catherine of Aragon, who was the youngest child of the royal house of Spain. Now, I see parents here with kids. Have any of you arranged a marriage when your daughter was 3 to a boy who was 2? I've never myself met anybody who did that, but that's what happened to Arthur, the son of Henry VII, and Catherine, who was the youngest child of the royal house of Spain. Now, what's really interesting about Catherine is to know who her parents were. If I say the names Ferdinand and Isabella, who do you think of? Christopher Columbus. Well, when you think about Ferdinand and Isabella, think about Catherine of Aragon. She was their daughter. So we've already mentioned Columbus twice in our story here. We had the little poem earlier. Now we have the daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella, who is engaged to the son of the King of England. It was a royal match that was made for specific political purposes. Henry VII believed that by associating his family with the ancient and royal house of Spain, he would increase his own legitimize his reign and earn some prestige from that relationship. The power and the prestige of Spain would be joined to his own House of Tudor in England, and it would raise his profile in Europe. So this engagement was made. The Spanish monarch seemed to think that it would be good for them to be associated in this way with England, and in a sense, now, this sounds really bad, but you could imagine them thinking they weren't giving up much if they were giving up their youngest, their sixth child, to go to England and to join together in this marriage. The marriage took place in November 1501. Arthur was 15 and she was 16. They were just teenagers. Now, it was a traditional wedding ceremony that involved everything traditional about the marriage. About 6 months later, Arthur died suddenly. We're not exactly sure why he died, but at this point, Catherine is a widow. A suitable period of time was waited to ensure that Catherine was not pregnant, and after that was done, Henry was made Prince of Wales, And the king, Henry VII, decided that the best thing to do in order to continue this prestigious relationship with Spain was to transfer his daughter-in-law from Arthur to Henry. And so she was betrothed to his second son. Now, there's a whole lot that we could say about this marriage. It took quite a few years for it to finally happen, but it did. And when Henry came to the throne after his father died, he had just recently been married to Catherine of Aragon, a woman who had been his brother's legal wife. All right? Now, that leads to a problem later on. Henry comes to the throne. He's married and lives with Catherine for about 20 years. They have 5 children. But Catherine only gave to Henry one surviving child, a girl, and that is Mary, who later comes to the throne. Their other 4 children all die. The first was a girl. Then there were 3 boys. One of them lived for 52 days, but died after 52 days. And then there was a 6th child, another girl, and she lived only briefly after birth. Now, what this meant over the course of about 20 years is that Mary gave birth to 6 children, but there were no sons who survived, and so Henry did not have a son who could become an heir to the throne. And he was deeply concerned about this because there were all of the problems associated with the ongoing dynasty of the Tudors and his desire to ensure a line of succession for his family. He wanted a son. He wanted a son who would follow him and become king. Now, one of the realities of the day is that they didn't understand genetics. And they believed that it was the responsibility of the woman to produce a male heir. And so Henry began to think through this matter and seems to have begun to blame his wife Catherine for the fact that there was no male heir and also that the other children had died as stillbirths along the way. Henry began to think about this and began to be concerned. Now, remember what I said before, that Henry had been intended by his father early on for the church? It seems that Henry had some kind of theological education along the way. And at some point, he began to read texts from the Law of Moses, like this in Leviticus 18:16. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your brother's wife. It is your brother's nakedness. Leviticus 20, verse 21. If a man takes his brother's wife, it is an unclean thing. He has uncovered his brother's nakedness. Then the scripture says, they shall be childless. Now, Henry read these texts, and he seems to have been deeply affected, and he began to wonder if the succession of children who died and the failure to have a male heir who lived was the judgment of God upon him for being married at this point to his brother's widow. It does seem that there was some genuineness to Henry's concern. He, in a strange way, he seems to have taken religion seriously, at least in some things, though not in everything. And here he had an explanation, or he was developing an explanation, for the problems that were taking place in his home. He was married to the wife of his deceased brother. Now, there is more to the picture. Henry was not a chaste man, and Henry had a roving eye. We know that he had at least 2 mistresses. There are several others who have been suggested. One was a woman named Elizabeth Blunt, and she bore to him a son whose name was Henry Fitzroy, Henry the son of the king. But Henry Fitzroy could never succeed his father to the throne. It was known that he was illegitimate. It's also thought, and probably accurately, that Henry had an affair with his second wife's sister, Mary Boleyn. And there are several others that have been suggested along the way. Now, he does have Mary Boleyn as a mistress, And Mary's sister comes to court. Her name was Anne. She was a young and attractive lady. And she caught his eye right at the time when he began to think that he should end the marriage with his wife, Catherine. We've said that he's probably reflecting on these texts from the law of God and considering what happened in his family to be a judgment, but at the same time, his eye is noticing this girl and he's attracted to her. Now, if you read about the life of Henry VIII, you'll find that there's a lot of debate about the character of Anne Boleyn. There's one school of thought that says she was a young lady who wanted to advance her own cause, and she flirted with the king and arranged for the relationship herself. There are others who say, no, that's not the case. She was actually a very devout woman. She's called an evangelical, which is the early name for the Reformation, and she supported Reformation causes. Now, I don't have a conclusive answer on this for you, except to say that I've been more convinced by those who argue that probably she was an evangelical rather than a flirt. But you will find both of those cases made in the story about Anne. In any case, she refused the advances of the king. He sent her letters, made it known to her that he wanted her to be his mistress, and she said no. At least her moral scruples prevented her, though she did say she would give herself to him if she were the Queen of England, or if she could be assured of being the Queen of England. Now, what I'm trying to do is paint to you a picture here that's very complex of what's about to happen. Henry's solution to this problem is to end the marriage to Catherine of Aragon and to take a new wife. But he doesn't seek it by way of a divorce, and he doesn't try to find anything against Catherine. He seems to have had some affection towards her. They lived together as husband and wife for some 20 years. Rather, what he sought was approval from the Pope to annul the marriage. Now, there's a whole lot more to this story that I wish that I could tell you. But he sought permission from the Pope on the basis that he had violated a principle of Scripture in marrying his brother's wife, hence the judgment of God upon his family. And Henry believed that if he would receive what was called a dispensation from the Pope, he would then be able to marry an unencumbered and suitable woman who would then be able to produce for him an heir. He sought the advice of the theology faculty at the two great universities, Oxford and Cambridge. They came back with mixed opinions. He actually communicated with some of the Reformation churches on the continent. They weren't willing to help him out at this point. The Pope was very slow in considering the matter. There's a couple of reasons for that. The Pope who had named him defender of the faith was long gone. In fact, they were on the fourth Pope after him. There was Leo X and Adrian VI and Clement VII, as well as Julius. And this Pope was unwilling to grant Henry's wishes. Now, there's a variety of reasons for this. One of them, remember who Catherine was. She was the sixth child of the royal house of Spain. She had important political connections. And the Pope was afraid of causing difficulties with the Spanish house. Likewise, the Holy Roman Emperor, who was Charles V, was Catherine's nephew. And he had recently invaded and taken control of Rome, and so he had the Pope under his thumb. Her nephew is basically in Rome telling the Pope, don't do this, don't do this, I don't want you to do this, and he's the Holy Roman Emperor. So the Pope basically comes to the conclusion that he cannot grant Henry the dispensation. Now, what does Henry do? Well, the short answer to that question is that Henry thumbed his nose at the Pope, and in 1534, he separated from the Church of Rome, and he declared himself to be, here are the words, the supreme head on earth of the Church of England, and he pushed the Pope out of the country. He erected what's called the doctrine of royal supremacy. in which he asserted that the king was the only and the final ruler of the Church of England. Now, dear friends, this is not a theological reformation of the Church of England. This is a political ploy on the part of Henry VIII to push the Pope out. But you know what happened when the Pope was pushed out? The opportunity for the Reformation came in. We need to understand this carefully because it explains a lot of what happens for the next 100 years. This is a political separation of the Church of England from the papacy and an assertion of the doctrine of royal supremacy. Henry claims for himself, and he's followed in this by Edward, he's followed in this by Mary, although she's tentative, and he is certainly followed in this by Elizabeth, who believe that they are the head of the Church of England and they have the right to lead it in whatever direction they choose. In fact, after Elizabeth, when James I comes to the throne, and then Charles I comes to the throne, and then the Puritans revolt against Charles I, all of this is explained by the doctrine of royal supremacy. The king or the queen says, I am the ruler, I am the head, this is my empire, this is my land, I will do as I please. And I claim this right not only over the state, but over the church as well. Henry based his doctrine on an extension of his political view of the divine right of kings. As a king, he claimed absolute political right within his realm. It was a logical extension of this principle to apply it to the church also within his realm. He didn't claim this for France or Spain or Germany. He claimed it for England. It was the first time. It was an innovation, but it makes sense. Henry had an exalted view of himself, a very medieval view of himself, but this is what happened when he came to the throne. Now, to rush ahead, let me say a couple of things. Henry dies in 1547, and he does have one male heir to follow him, Edward VI, as we've already heard. But Edward was a boy of 9 years old. Edward only lived for 6 years. He died when he was 15. Died very suddenly. But Edward was a heartfelt Protestant. He believed in the Reformation doctrines. And he had around him, he wasn't old enough to reign as king, but he had around him a council who reigned in his stead. And the council was made up of men who themselves were committed to the Reformation. So for the period from 1547 to 1553, the 6 years when Edward is at least in title the head of the King of England, the Reformation moves forward by leaps and bounds. The problem is that when you have 9,000 parish churches in the country, and when the Reformation begins at the top level, you don't have priests one day who become ministers the next day suddenly changing their theological views. What if tomorrow the government of the United States of America declared that all American citizens belong to X religion, whatever it is? Does that change you? Does that change your pastor and his views? Of course not. And because King Henry VIII broke with Rome, that doesn't mean that anyone necessarily underneath him broke with Rome as well. So when Edward comes to the throne as a heart-committed Protestant surrounded by men who are heart-committed Protestants, they face the problem of clergy who are still Roman Catholics. So what do? Well, they put together something called the Book of Common Prayer and the Book of Homilies. This was a necessity. The Book of Common Prayer was a book in which they put together forms that were to be used in the worship of God. And the homilies were sermons that were to be read. And they put these things together because they believed that they could ensure that no matter what the convictions were of the man who used to be the priest, if he read these things, which by law he was required to do, if he read these things week after week in church, then the Reformation doctrines would be heard and hopefully believed by the people who sat in those churches week after week. What else do you do in those circumstances? You don't have 9,000 ministers that you can send out to all of the different parishes. You have to find some way to do it. It seems to me it was a good way. It was expediency, but how else do you do it? Well, that was their attempt. Now, what happens is this. Edward dies. Mary comes to the throne. She's a bitter woman who is a Roman Catholic from the heart. Why is she a bitter woman? Well, think about it like this. Her mother was put away by her father, and she was by that action changed from being a legitimate child to an illegitimate child. Her legitimacy was changed by the action of her father. Because once he declared that the marriage was no longer a valid marriage, what she had been, she was no longer. Now, she was raised all of her life and trained to be a devout Roman Catholic. So when she came to the throne, when her brother died in 1553, and she's the next, she was actually the oldest of the surviving children, but Edward came to the throne because he was a boy, a male. When Mary comes to the throne, she tries to undo everything that had been accomplished under Edward. And you know what her nickname was, Bloody Mary. Because there were almost 300 who were burned at the stake as a result of their Protestant views. About another 800 theologians fled to the continent of Europe. 300 burned at the stake. Some of the descriptions are gruesome. Mary dies in 1558 from cancer. She has no children. And she's followed to the throne by her half-sister, who was the daughter of Anne Boleyn, and her name was Elizabeth. And Elizabeth reigned for about 50 years until 1603. Now, Elizabeth seems to have been a Protestant, but she wanted a church that was in between. And what's called the Elizabethan settlement, or the Middle Way, was the result in the Church of England, and it explains why the Church of England is even what it is today. It looks, when you go into many of the parishes in the Church of England, it looks like a Roman Catholic church, but it has Protestant doctrine. That's the Middle Way. That's the Elizabethan settlement. Elizabeth was a woman who didn't like preaching, interestingly enough. So she believed that it was only necessary to have one preacher in each of the counties in England. And she believed that the homilies, which had been published under her half-brother Edward, was all that was necessary for the parishes of the Church of England. So you would come and you would listen to these homilies being read to you. She discouraged preaching in the churches. The 800 theologians who had fled from Mary's reign and had spent time in places like Strasbourg and Geneva came back having seen fully reformed churches, and they wanted the Reformation to progress in England. But Elizabeth didn't want that. And she was the supreme governor of the Church of England. So a circumstance developed in which there was a class of men in the Church of England under Elizabeth who were unhappy with her resistance to further Reformation. And that's the beginning of Puritanism. They were crying out for the church to move forward, to become more like Strasbourg, to become more like Geneva, to take seriously all of the things that are written in Scripture and implement them in the Church of England. So that in the 1570s and 1580s, for example, you have a man like Thomas Cartwright, who is the leading theologian at the University of Cambridge, arguing for a full-blown Reformation. And Elizabeth so offended by him that she drives him out of the country. You have Edmund Grindal, who was her Archbishop of Canterbury. Elizabeth told him that he needed to take steps to ensure that prophesying, preaching, was suppressed in the Church of England. He wrote a courageous letter back to her and said, "It's more important for me to obey God than to obey you, my monarch. I can't do this." And she basically shut him down so he had no longer any influence in the church. And the men who had convictions to implement the truth of Scripture were frustrated by this. And it led to the development of Puritanism within the church, but it led others to be so frustrated that they left the church and they became what we call today separatists. Now, it's the separatists who are really important for our story as Baptists, because largely, though not exclusively, the Baptists come as a result of the separatist movement in the Church of England. Now, I look at my watch and I see it's 5 minutes before six, so I better stop right there with the separatists. And God willing, when we come back after we eat, we'll talk about the separatists and the development of the Baptists in England. We don't even have time at this point for questions, I think. If you want me to, it's your call. Okay? Anybody want to ask a question then? He's my boss. We've already heard that, so I better do what he wants me to do. Yes? Well, the Anabaptists at this point are all European, if I can make a distinction between Europeans and British or English. They're all on the other side of the English Channel. Some of them come to England in order to flee persecution, but really at this point they're all foreigners. And so they're a little bit outside of the story in terms of the Church of England. And it's pretty well agreed among academic researchers that there aren't any Baptists in England until you get to the 17th century. And also, let me say this, the word Anabaptist in the 16th century is an umbrella term it's a mud term. You use it to throw mud at somebody and you try to make it stick. It's like the term fundamentalist. Now, I don't think of myself as a fundamentalist, but most liberal theologians would label me as a fundamentalist. And they would want anything bad that you can think about fundamentalism to be labeled for me. Because I believe in the inspiration, the inerrancy of Holy Scripture. That's a fundamentalist in their mind. Anabaptist was like that. We know for certain that some who were called Anabaptists and were burned at the stake for being Anabaptists simply denied that the doctrine of transubstantiation, the miraculous change of the wafer in the Roman Catholic Eucharist into the body and blood of Christ. They didn't practice believers' baptism at all, but that was the mud word that was used to describe them. Separatist was a bad word, too. Nobody wanted to be known as a separatist. Any other questions at this point? All right. Yes. Well, that's a good question. It's largely religious, but you have to remember that we're in the late Middle Ages, and their conception of the relationship of church and state is not anything like our conception today. We have to be very careful not to read our separation of church and state back into them, so that when you separate from the church, you are considered to be separating from the state as well. Let me give you an example. And maybe we'll talk about this in the next hour. When you and your wife have a child, the legitimacy of your child and his or her right to inherit your property when you die depends upon the baptismal certificate that you received when you brought your child to the local parish and had your child baptized by the local priest. If you couldn't prove that, there wasn't a record in the church building, then your child was not considered to be legitimate by the state. So that's how closely tied church and state were to each other. And some of us, you might see a mystery on PBS or something from the 18th century where a guy has to prove that he's the rightful heir of something and he can't find the church book because it's been destroyed in the fire and has to go through the whole thing. When we come to the story of the Baptists, we need to remember this point because some of them were very brave. They were rich men who had a lot at stake. When they refused to allow their children to be baptized, they were actually putting the inheritance of their children in jeopardy by that action. So it wasn't just a religious step that they were taking when they refused to commit themselves to infant baptism. There was a whole lot more at stake than that. So we have to be careful with that concept. That's a very good question.
Jim.
Yeah, there were executions all the time. They weren't. There were some religious heretics, those who were considered to be heretics, who were martyred. And there were some who had to flee. Cartwright had to flee. Now, I don't think he would have been executed, but he had to leave the country. Right. Yeah. What's called Fox's Book of Martyrs was actually written under Elizabeth's authority. And its title is actually The Acts and Monuments is the proper title, not Fox's Book of Martyrs. But it's intended to make Mary look really bad and make Elizabeth look good. Is what it's about. I'm in the middle of reading a whole bunch of them. David Starkey is an author who has done some really good work on Henry VIII. And he did a PBS series called The Six Wives of Henry VIII. You may have seen that on TV. It's actually quite good. And his stuff on Henry VIII would be readable and very interesting. Jeffrey Morehouse did a book on the dissolution of the monasteries, which I didn't even mention, called The Last Divine Office, which is very good. The standard biography, which haven't finished yet, so I don't know if I can recommend it, is by a guy named Scarisbrake. There's loads of literature out there.
And what do you think of Fulton May's Reformation, Church of England, some of the reading?
The name is actually Merle d'Aubigné, is his full surname. John Henry Merle d'Aubigné, like Martin Lloyd-Jones. And that's very good. It's 150 years old now, and there's a lot of information that has come to light since then. But it certainly is worth reading.